what interested you about the Vreeland story to the point where you thought you would personally do your investigation?
Well, that's a good place to start. I've been skeptical about what I call 9/11 theory. There are different theories going over the internet since the 9/11 disaster that happened in my hometown in New York. I was skeptical of these conspiracy theories that Bush might have had foreknowledge, that U.S. intelligence had foreknowledge. And so since I was skeptical, I decided to evaluate them and try to get an independent perspective on them and find out who was credible and who was not credible. And so I did that, and I did a big article for a Canadian magazine called Heads that kind of evaluated what was actually credible out there about, you know, who's making a good case. And I found actually that I personally found this guy Jared Israel at emperorsnewclothes.com to be the most credible of the different theorists out there, and thought that he had the most scientific, rational approach with the best sources and the best documentation. So to answer your question, Mike Rupert, who I know has been a guest on your program before, was also trying to substantiate and try to figure out, you know, who knew what and what was credible. And so he, at this time I was doing the 9/11 research, you know, he was pursuing this whole other thing with this guy Delmar Vreeland. And, you know, again, I was very skeptical at first, but the more I looked into it, the more it seemed that people were just beginning to touch the tip of an iceberg, and that you know, a good independent researcher would be a welcome addition to the gang of people trying to find out the truth.
What the first thing you found out about Vreeland then, when you started looking at the story, and I'm going to hazard a guess here, but I'll assume it's a fairly accurate one, and you can tell me, information about his extensive criminal record.
That's true. I have access to LexisNexis, which is the journalist's tool to access everything that's been in print on somebody. So it's kind of like a high-end internet, not just anything that anybody puts on the net, but anything that's actually made it into a major magazine or newspaper. And mm-hmm. I found some stuff that I felt that actually Mike Rupert hadn't even found yet or wasn't really exploring. And so I emailed him this report from Crane's Detroit Business saying it was when Vreeland was busted or convicted of participating in the arson case against Bobby Moore's, involving Bobby Moore's restaurant. And I was like, this is really weird. You know, this guy has the same unusual name. Is this the same guy? And Mike Rupert actually had already seen that, and he said, yes, it's the same guy. There's, you know, he said something like, it's a long story here. It is the same guy. And so I thought I had like this big scoop then that Rupert hadn't actually seen yet. And that actually kind of scared me off the story. I was like, this is creepy. This guy has been convicted of arson in the 80s or the 90s. And
yeah, that's a strange story actually, because he couldn't have possibly committed the arson. You know that, right?
Well,
he was in jail at the time.
Well,
according to Eric Kaiser, Vreeland would have been in jail at the time, but he pled guilty to the arson as part of the agreement for his testimony.
Right. Well, I don't actually, I'm not totally certain about when Vreeland was or was not in jail.
There's a copy of the agreement, actually, I think that Vreeland put it on his website, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I'm not so certain what about the official record can be trusted and what cannot be trusted. I know that kind of throws us into this nebulous world of what is true and what's not true. And I don't mean to say that, like, you know, I'm doubting the existence of facts. I know that the facts are out there, but the official record about Vreeland has also been proven to have deliberate distortions. Do you agree with that? Do you recognize that?
I think that the records that were provided to the extradition hearing in Canada here, some of them appear to be flawed.
Right.
But they also say right on them that, you know, some of this information could be incorrect. And I understand that, it's my understanding that Kevin Wilson's going to be presenting a more complete and more accurate criminal record next week. But I guess that remains to be seen.
Yeah, I'm not so sure how much I trust Kevin Wilson and the prosecution in this case. But anyway, that's a whole other question. I guess you know, you've just proven it right there yourself. You're saying, like, this is really weird. He was supposed to be in prison, and yet he was convicted of participating in this arson case.
That's been explained to me to my satisfaction, though, but I don't want
to... Okay, well, let me tell you what Vreeland told me personally about this.
Okay.
I asked him, how did you get involved in this crazy, kooky case against this iconoclastic, eccentric person who was allegedly a cocaine dealer, who was allegedly smuggling cocaine through the digestive tracts of his herd of elephants, according at least to law enforcement in
you're speaking
Michigan
of
at the time, and according to my interview with the DA, our assistant DA Kaiser, who you mentioned earlier. I said, like, how did you get involved with this? Especially because Bobby Moore, the impresario in question, is married to your stepsister. And he said, well, it was actually a deliberate choice of mine because I wanted to get revenge upon Bobby Moore and bust him. And
revenge for what?
Revenge for, he always felt Bobby Moore was creepy and was always trying to recruit him into his cocaine dealings, at least according to what Vreeland said. I'm not saying that's true or not, but that's what Vreeland has told me. And then I pointed out, well, you didn't, things didn't exactly go according to plan if that was your plan, because, you know, Bobby Moore was not actually convicted of burning down his restaurant in that arson case. And then Vreeland said, well, he did, in fact, not get paid back for the restaurant from the insurance company, and, you know, he did lose that restaurant, although, of course, he went on to do other restaurants. I'm wondering though if the Bobby Moore thing is maybe a little bit too esoteric. Maybe we should back up and talk more about general.
Actually, I'd like to jump onto that Bobby Moore part and what you were saying about Vreeland. You said that Vreeland said that he didn't want to get involved with this Bobby Moore, who he says was creepy and was involved with drugs and cocaine. Wouldn't that be the perfect thing for Vreeland to get involved in, because he was involved with Office of Navy Intelligence? He had practice in infiltrating drug rings and things like this. Wouldn't he just jump at that chance?
Well, that's just it. Yeah, I think that there's something that was irking him about Bobby Moore, and he claims to have used his ONI background to try to set up Bobby Moore. Now, the thing is, Vreeland is very much a bumbling, fallible human being. Who, and as you know, I know that you guys have ridiculed him on your website. And
thank you.
Without endorsing that, I will say that, you know, Vreeland is definitely not things don't always go according to plan with Vreeland. So, you know, what he wanted to do and what actually happened were very different things.
But he would have the backing of the U.S. government, supposedly, if he was involved with the ONI. Why would things go so terribly wrong? I mean, why would he be left out there if he's got the backing? He even says himself that, why would I get into doing this myself? You quote him about being a con man, that, you know,
right.
he suggests that he's the best con man in the world.
Right.
And why would the best con man want to do it on his own? You'd want to do it with a lot of backup.
Well, I'll tell you, Greg, I mean, in this case, in this story I've been on for 5 months, you know, I've talked to a lot of people in U.S. intelligence, and it really has struck me that U.S. intelligence isn't this divine, stealthy force that, you know, they have all the power in the world and all the technology in the world, and things just go according to, you know, things just, they snap their fingers and their secret little plans go off. U.S. intelligence is a very human business, and you know, you still are dealing with the material world and unreliable human beings. So I think that the answer to that is, you know, even if he's theoretically working for the government, doesn't mean that he has the entire apparatus of the U.S. state behind him, and that they're still operating in the material world.
Where would you place Vreeland in a pecking order? He says, oh, I'm just a courier. Do you think that's the truth, or would you place him at a higher or lower echelon?
Well,
seeing
if you
were running an
operation in U.S. intelligence, where would you put Vreeland?
I
personally would probably treat him like a grunt. You know, he'd probably be like on the front lines of my operation. I wouldn't make him a commander or a manager. He's more like a soldier.
So that tallies with, would you say that tallies with how Vreeland sees himself?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he told Jeff Rentz in his interview that he was a glorified mailman in Moscow. And that, you know, Vreeland has he strikes me as having kind of a working-class soldier's consciousness. He's not all that sophisticated politically or in any other way.
Now, you spoke about a certain woman who's involved in arms trading.
Yeah.
But when would she have come to know of Vreeland then?
Well, the woman in question, her name's Eva Telecki, and I can't make direct reference to anything she's told me because she insisted on being off the record, but we can talk about her because she comes into the story because other people have made reference to her on the record. So with due respect to her, Al Martin, former ONI operative, told me that she is, in fact, an arms dealer of Hungarian ethnic origin who was actually indicted in the Iran-Contra lawsuits. At one point, the U.S. government sued Richard Secord in an attempt to kind of cover up Iran-Contra and to say that it was only $40 million that was brought in from arms sales to Iran. The result of this case, Greg, was that all the arms dealers involved in Iran-Contra were actually named. And Al Martin told me that in this case, U.S. government versus Secord, you can actually look up all these arms dealers, and one of them was named DEFCON Holdings Limited or something like that, and that's Eva Telecki's company. So he knew exactly who I was talking about right off the bat. So Eva Telecki wasn't just this name that Delmar Vreeland was throwing around or that other people involved in this story were throwing around, but it, you know, an outsider to the case, Al Martin, who I'm, you know, interviewing to get more background about ONI and other, you know, U.S. intelligence operations. You know, Al Martin, right off the bat, was like, oh, yeah, she's an arms dealer. So that actually is, I think, one of the most credible parts of my story.
And you've spoken with her?
Yeah, I have. And
what was the result of the criminal case involving the Iran-Contra affair? And who else? Can you just do you know of any other people that were involved? Any other notable figures besides Secord?
In this case, it was Secord that was being sued by the Department of Justice, USG. You know, so I haven't actually had the time to follow up this thread and get the full story. But anybody that wants to get it can either email me, and I'll give you the exact court docket, you know, court documents, docket number to look it up, or I can just tell you it's U.S. government versus Richard Secord.
Okay, fair enough.
On the web, there's actually some stuff about it on the web. No, and the answer is no. I don't know. I don't have that much more information about that case. But your first question about Eva was, I guess, what's the relationship to Vreeland? And like I say in the piece, Vreeland told me about a week and a half ago in Toronto that in his note about 9/11, he deliberately in jail made reference to certain things that would kind of spark and cause sort of, they would initiate the involvement of other people. Almost like they were codes in a way. And I mean, Eva's denied this to me, but he says at one point he was making reference to some weapons that he was privy to knowledge of the sale of these weapons, and Eva was somehow involved, and that was how Eva got involved. Now, through Eva, other people got involved that are very interesting to the story, and no one's really explored these threads yet. I feel like this is the new ground that I've struck with this story. Suffice to say, both Eva and her business associates became involved in trying to work with Vreeland somehow, and they all felt they knew the same people in common. I mean, this is really freaky, but the people I'm talking about now are Leo Wanta and his legal advisor, Tom Henry. For those who don't know, and that's probably most of your listeners tonight, Leo Wanta is a former Reagan White House kind of clandestine operative. He calls himself Ronald Reagan's favorite junkyard dog. He calls himself a former taskmaster for Reagan. And, I mean, there's a pretty clear public record about him. If you do a LexisNexis report on Wanta, you see that he was involved in 1988 in an arms deal to Noriega. That was clearly documented. There's a book called Thieves' World by a woman named Claire Sterling. The book is actually now out of print, as are a lot of these books that deal with international financial dealings of great magnitude, that a lot of these books that seek to reveal the truth about capital flows that are linked to power. You see a lot of these books over time, or in a very short time, go out of print. You know, if there's somebody with a lot of money buys up the print run and buys up the rights, and the book dies. But actually, that's one thing that Mike Rupert has done a great job of, is listed books on his website that people should really try to get, even though they're out of print. You know, you'd have to buy them used. But anyway, so Thieves World by Claire Sterling mentions Leo Wanta and talks about his involvement in destabilizing the Russian ruble. And a lot of people think this sounds crazy, but at least according to Claire Sterling's book, in 1991-1992, Leo Wanta was involved in trying to help the demise of the Soviet state by something involving many, many metric tons of Russian gold that somehow disappeared and I think helped destabilize their bank and their currency, and as we know, swiftly led to, or shortly thereafter, the Soviet state crumbled.
What else do you know about Claire Sterling?
I know that she was 89 years old, was kind of like this pretty well-respected grandmother, colloquially referred to as like this grandmother of independent researchers. The only review of her book I could find was from a Japanese newspaper. I think she's somewhat controversial, but I actually went to a pretty good source. There's this great site on the net called PIR.org, which I believe is publicinterestresearch.org, and they are kind of a left-of-center, authoritative bibliography of a lot of different books about media history, mostly media history and politics, and give you a pretty fair assessment of different books, and they gave Claire Sterling's book a pretty fair shake. So, why? Do you have a different opinion of her?
Yes.
What is your opinion of her?
She's a CIA agent.
I didn't know that.
She's the person that spread the lies that Mehmet Ali Agha worked for Eastern European governments who organized the killing of, or the attempted killing of, Pope John Paul II, which has been completely debunked. If you look up, are you familiar with Mae Brussel?
Yeah, I actually am familiar with Mae Brussel.
Look, do a search about Mae Brussel and Claire Sterling. I think you'll find a lot of information about that. But it was Mae Brussel and Dave Emery also did a lot of work about Claire Sterling and exposed her as being a CIA operative living in Italy and involved with the P2 Masonic Lodge.
Well, that actually is pretty consistent with what I was trying to say earlier about the nature of U.S. intelligence. That not everybody's on the same side. There's a lot of division. It's almost like what Karl Marx said about the ruling class. They love to seduce each other's wives.
And the reason that the print runs are so small on those books and why they are withdrawn is because all of the publishing companies are CIA publishing companies.
All of them? That seems like to be a general statement.
Well, you'll find that none of these books are generally published by mainstream press, and that they come out when they're politically needed.
Well, that begs the question, then, why would the CIA be publishing this information about Leo Wanta? And
that's a good question, actually.
Do you want to suggest that Leo Wanta was in the employ of the CIA? I've got proof. I mean, he sent me his resume. His resume says that he has worked for CIA, U.S. Treasury, et cetera, et cetera. It's a beautiful document. It shows a lot of interesting defense contracting. He has a background in metallurgy. He knows how to, you know, he knows a lot about the science of metals. He's worked in the private sector and defense contracting he was telling me about re-smelting this gold. I mean, this story is huge, and I can't believe how much like an octopus it is almost.
But what's his purpose in coming out and saying all these things, in saying that, yeah, I destabilized the Russian ruble. I stole, or I helped steal all the gold out of Russia. What's his point of doing that?
Well, he's also, again, a human being, getting older, suffering from rheumatism and arthritis. He's in constant pain. He's currently under house arrest in Wisconsin, which is a form of parole, because he was swiftly convicted of income tax evasion in Wisconsin in the in 1993. And this is another bizarre twist and turn of the Vreeland story. But according to my research, or at least according to what my sources have told me, is that Leo Wanta and Vince Foster, the former Clinton White House lawyer, and Delmart Vreeland were all in Switzerland in 1993 trying to effect some sort of currency, well, not exactly a currency affair. It was more like a capital flows affair, funds transfer. And this is what Vreeland is trying to sometimes document by haphazardly releasing financial documents, or FINs, F-I-N's, on his website, which not everybody can make sense of because they're not really well explained. But these FINs have to do with capital, international capital flows. And to make a long story short, something went wrong in Switzerland. There's bizarre details and there's bizarre allegations about what happened. What we do know is right after late June, early July of this a board of meeting in Switzerland in 93, Leo Wanta was arrested in Switzerland, swiftly extradited without a warrant back to the U.S. In leg and hand and neck shackles. And he was put on trial in Wisconsin for tax evasion, even though he had not lived in Wisconsin for about 5 or 6 years. And the federal government said, no, he actually has no tax liability to us. But Wisconsin was able to somehow tweak it and get their local courts and media establishment to play along, and swiftly convicted of what looks to be like a railroading for some reason. Now, again, it's like, you know, I thought this guy was a Reagan White House hero. You know, I thought this guy was, you know, former CIA, former U.S. Treasury. My answer to that is, well, according to his resume, he is. And according to the public record, he obviously does have some sort of powerful or some sort of documented past with major U.S. political power. Now, why then was he extradited and shame-faced in this kangaroo court in Wisconsin for this, you know, accused of being insane in public and just ridiculed and swiftly convicted of these bizarre Wisconsin tax evasion charges, which if you examine the court records, it seems completely bizarre. I mean, they accused him of owing $16,000 in back taxes, and so he paid it twice under protest, and then they still convicted him, and they put him under house arrest for 25 years.
Let's actually take this opportunity to fast forward to the point where Wanta's and Vreeland's story
merge.
Merge, yes.
To make a long story short, Tom Henry, Leo Wanta's legal advisor, was a former U.S. attorney under the Department of Justice and used to be a lawyer, and now he's working as a consultant. Tom Henry wrote Vreeland a memo, and this is going to be released, or by the time this interview is broadcast, it will have been released on the Guerrilla News Network website, which is gnn.tv. You can see this memo. On February 13th, 2002, Tom Henry sends Delmart Vreeland a memo saying, I represent former U.S. government officials. What he meant was Leo Wanta. And I'm interested in contacting you and trying to find out if you are legitimately a former intelligence operative. And what Henry did was he, according to his memo, he asked Vreeland some questions and tried to determine if Vreeland actually knew his stuff using certain jargon and security passwords. And according to Henry's memo, Vreeland passed with flying colors. And that prompted Wanta to try to work with Vreeland this past year on the recovery of certain amounts of major capital. I'm talking about, I've heard different numbers, and again, this is according to my research and and documents I have, but it's also, you know, it's also completely bonkers. The kind of numbers we're talking about here are something like $16 trillion that somehow in Leo Wanta's past financial wranglings, his work with different international financial capitalists, his work with UN Contract 4, which had to do with international capital trying to mitigate the crisis in the Middle East, somehow, and also has something to do with the destabilization of the Russian ruble and the missing, like, 200 metric tons of Russian gold that's missing. Anyway, certain amounts of capital were lost during these transactions, and now Wanta has been trying to recover this money. And at one point, guess who he hired? At one point, he hired Delmar Vreeland, which is either a blow to the credibility of Leo Wanta or a testament to the credibility of Delmar Vreeland.
He hired Delmar Vreeland to do what again?
To help him recover funds.
Oh, you mean recently?
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess after February.
Right. Okay.
Right. After Wanta and Henry proved to their satisfaction that Delmar Vreeland was in fact a former intelligence operative of the U.S. So now this would all sound completely bonkers if I hadn't been in Toronto in a week and a half ago, and Vreeland did seem to be, frankly, he seemed to be living pretty well. You know, he at one point told me that he has a commission of 1% of anything he recovers, and he was in the midst of purchasing some real estate. So what does that tell us?
What do you think?
Yeah, well, what do I think? I think that, we've done stuff in the middle of a conversation with Leo Wanta, not we, but I have done stuff like say, all right, what's your date of birth? You know, or where'd you go to high school? Or how do we know it's really Leo Wanta? And he'll say stuff, you know, he'll respond frankly and calmly and tell us his date of birth and that he went to Washington High School in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I said, how do we know it's you? And he says, because I've had a stuttering problem since second grade and no one else would know that or something like that, you know? So
it's a good thing then that Delmar Vreeland didn't assassinate Leo Wanta in Switzerland then, otherwise he wouldn't be coming across all of this largesse.
Mentioning something that actually is not going to be in the final draft.
Oh, it isn't.
Story,
okay.
But, I mean, I would be willing to discuss it now because it's something that at the time Wanta and Vreeland were not acquainted.
We should give a little history here to tell people exactly what we're talking about.
What Greg
about.
Is bringing up, again, it's slightly esoteric. It's slightly one of the crazier, more minute details of this story. But according to Vreeland, actually, Vreeland told me this, and he insisted it be off the record, and that I never talk about this or put it in print. But then Wanta actually told me it on the record and said that he didn't care anymore and that he was in constant pain, and he complained of his treatment, the way he's been treated since 93 and the way he's being treated under house arrest in Wisconsin. And so he just said, I don't care. Let Sander Hicks know whatever is true. So what Wanta and Vreeland both said was that Vreeland was in Switzerland in 1993 when Wanta, Vince Foster, were also there, and that their directions, or Leo Wanta's directions as a agent of the U.S. Treasury, were to arrest the international financier Mark Rich, who, as we all know, had a mysterious last-minute pardon granted him by Bill Clinton right before Clinton left office. And, of course, there's rumors about how much money Rich actually funneled over to Bill Clinton, but without going into those unsubstantiated rumors, what Wanta says is that Mark Rich at the time was doing things that were contrary to U.S. interests with financial dealings with other countries like Iran and Iraq, and that therefore U.S. Treasury wanted him arrested. There, according to the story, the Office of Naval Intelligence provided some sort of live ammunition type cover in case, and to quote Lioananta, in case, well, to paraphrase Lioananta, I think he said something like, in case, you know, in case I was taken out, or in case, you know, I was, he said, Lioananta said, in case I was taken down and the, you know, the situation went chaotic. According to Vreeland, Vreeland was assigned to be a sniper who was, I guess, assigned to either shoot Mark Rich or otherwise participate in this arrest.
How do you reconcile that with the, you know, information that the Michigan Department of Corrections has put out that Vreeland was under their supervision at that time?
What Vreeland has told me is that that the prison that he was in had some sort of underground connection to a naval base, and that he said that if you look in the map, it's right next to a naval base. I know that sounds preposterous. I haven't personally checked out whether or not it's close to a naval base. It just hasn't been enough time, but it's worth checking out.
So Vreeland did admit he was in jail at the time, because it was my understanding.
No, I mean, he has said stuff like the reason that the record shows that I was in jail was that I would be. Well, I asked Vreeland, what was your directive at ONI? What was your day-to-day existence, you know, in your years at ONI? And he said, I played the criminal. That's what I would do. I would get arrested deliberately and put in the same cell as, you know, a drug dealer or somebody that we were trying to get information from and take down. And, I mean, that obviously is pretty consistent with his official record. He does seem to get arrested a lot to be syllable, and he seems to get arrested for his own personal foibles as well. You know, he drinks a lot, and he's I think has a history of being a pretty violent person. He seemed to be a very physical person when we were hanging out. And anyway,
do you believe the story, Sander, that he was that the U.S. government, after we've stated before that Vreeland was a courier and a grunt, that they would then suddenly assign him to be a sharpshooting assassin?
Yeah, again, I don't think that's inconsistent. I think a sharpshooting assassin is not the most managerial or high-end skill. It's a specialized skill, and he may well have had that skill. According to his story, he does, and he did. What I did, Greg, it's a good question, and what I did, and this actually was, well, what I did was kind of a little ambush journalism, and I talked to somebody who knew about the craft of being a sniper. I don't personally know anything about that much about guns, you know. So, but I talked to somebody who did, and he said, "Well, this story sounds really fishy. Why don't you call up Vreeland and ambush him with these questions?" And he gave me a list of questions to ask Vreeland on the phone, you know, unprepared, about sniper rifles, ammo. And because this guy, like the guy who told me this, was like, you know, snipers love their ammo and their weapons, and this, you know, if he's a real sniper, if he really has this skill, he'll be able to rattle off all of this stuff, and this was what I call the sniper smell test, you know, and Vreeland passed it. You know, I asked him these five or six questions. I think maybe you've seen an earlier draft of my piece that had this anecdote in it, and you know, and he. He answered on the phone. He seemed to know his stuff. That could be argued, well, he's a good con man and he had that base covered, but I don't think that's the case in this case.
So you talked to someone you knew that was not associated with Vreeland at all.
Right, it wasn't even in this country.
And they gave you the questions.
Yeah.
Did they give you the answers?
No, they didn't give me the answers.
So,
the answers like variable answers, like what kind of rifle were you using? What kind of scope? What kind of ammo? What was it? Was it handmade bullets or what? Store bought or whatever?
Then you got in touch with Vreeland.
Yeah.
Then you documented all of these answers.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got back to your contact abroad.
Mm-hmm.
and he verified that these made sense.
Not exactly. The contact abroad who I'm talking about is David Guy at Deep Black Lies, who has also done some research into Leo Wanta, but kind of is antagonistic to the subject or frustrated with the subject, and does not have feels that Vreeland lacks credibility and is not worth his time, and also feels that Leo Wanta has been psychologically damaged too much by the experiences he's been through and is inconsistent with supplying documents that he wanted. David Guyette at deepblacklies.com has also done a ton of research on the kind of international financial dealings that we're talking about. Although Leo Wanta and Tom Henry don't have a high opinion of him, they feel that his Project Hammer document is essentially false. He's got this PDF he's selling on his website called the Project Hammer document. I don't personally have an opinion either way. I think they're both interesting people. I think they both have a lot to contribute to the subject of mysterious international financial.
So what
dealing.
Did he? What did he say then?
As a journalist, both Wanta, Henry, and also Guyette have all been pretty helpful to me, and they seem to be helpful. Anyway,
what did
so,
Mr. Guyette say?
So that's the who we're talking about here. David Guyette gave me the sniper, analysis help. So if you're inferring that maybe Guyette tipped off Vreeland, I don't think
No, I'm not suggesting that. But you said something interesting when I went through the mechanics of how this all went on.
Mm-hmm.
You said that when you got back to him with the answers,
right, which seemed credible to me as a rational human being, I was like, well, that sort of satisfies.
But what did
I guess maybe I approached David Guyette enthusiastically and I said, look at this. And then Guyette backed away. He said, I don't personally, that doesn't prove anything to me. And I don't know why. I can't speak for David Guyette, but for me, it worked for me. You can judge whatever you want to judge from David Guyette's reaction. But anyway, what you mentioned, the first thing you mentioned is the most outlandish aspect of this is that that Vreeland originally was suggesting to one of his superiors when he was in his sniper roost that perhaps he should go through Leo Wanta's skull to hit Mark Rich, but that his superiors did not think that was a good idea. And that's something that they joke about now, as people that know each other better now in the present day.
In this other draft, and I wasn't sure what was included in your new one and about
right.
the assassin thing, I did actually discuss it with Ron earlier, and he suggested that this might still be in the article. But at any rate, I have the other version here, and it says here, Vreeland stated that his firing accuracy is 98%.
Yeah.
These are answers to the questions. Then it says, an expert on snipers confirmed that Vreeland knew his game. Now, is Mr. Guyette the man who is the expert on snipers?
Yes.
But don't you think that's a bit misleading? I'm thankful that you were, honest with us, or you told us, the version of the story you just did. But
mm-hmm.
do you think it's a little, given what you've just told us, where Guyette, you come back to Guyette with a whole bunch of information, and then Guyette says, "Well, I'm not buying that." And then, that's my impression, is that Guyette wasn't buying the answers. Now, have I got that wrong?
Yeah, hold on a second. Look at the email I originally got from David Guyette. David Guyette literally emailed me back, and this is what he said. I recommend you do a search on sniper rifles or Winchester sniper rifles at all, and then contact someone who is clearly an expert from some of the postings you read. There are a number of things that worried me about Vreeland's answers, but most of all, it was his singular answers, not expanding on them and getting trapped in them. It was a difference of...
I mean, really what you're saying, Sander, is that you're saying that Guyette is anti-Vreeland. Essentially,
yeah, he's anti-Vreeland,
and I felt
that
little...
he had a good suggestion, and I did it, and Vreeland passed the test. But then Guyette and I had a difference. The email I'm looking at right now is talks about Vreeland's style of answering questions. That he feels that Vreeland's answers are too short, and that they were too curt.
But can I suggest something here, Sander? And maybe it's too late to do this, but I mean, if Guyot is stonewalling you, as you seem to suggest he is, I mean, and I would say that saying an expert on snipers confirmed that Vreeland knew his game, that does not sound like what is being said in that email. But would it not? I wouldn't mind getting in touch with someone who's involved in such things and asking them these questions and seeing what they come up with without knowing Vreeland from a hole in the wall. And see whether, and then get their answers, and then start to.
Who do you suggest?
I don't know. I mean, I've never thought of phoning up snipers. I mean, I don't believe that Vreeland was an assassin. I think he only came up with this story after he knew about Wanta and learned more about Wanta's story. Mm-hmm. But that's my view of it. But anyway, but the thing is that, I grant you that as having Guyot give you the answers wouldn't have been privy to his concerns, or that would have created concerns for him, because if he gave you the answers to the questions that he's given you to ask Vreeland, then he would automatically, if you came back and says, hey, he got them all right, he would assume that you'd given him the answers, right? So, it just seems like a little flawed experiment, shall we say. It doesn't provide very conclusive proof of anything other than that Vreeland can come up with quick answers that aren't necessarily accurate, because we don't know how accurate these are. I mean, you're saying that
well, this is the deal. No, I actually got the sense from David Guyot that the answers were in fact accurate, and the problem was that right after this happened, Guyot got an email from Leo Wanta, or got a phone call from Leo Wanta, and then, to literally quote David Guyot, he suspected a, quote, connected game plan going on here. He just felt that I think he was just sort of creeped out by the subject. I felt that since Guyot didn't literally say, oh, my God, you know, Vreeland is obviously a liar and obviously false when he claims to be a sniper, Guyot did not question the actual essence of the data that came back from the sniper smell test.
Okay, I see your point.
What Guyot did, I mean, Guyot's background, he's like City of London financier who kind of, you know, went off the yuppie track and became more of an independent media person like you and like me. And I think he's a little bit, like, he's got an eye on his back. He doesn't want to become like Danny Casolaro. And maybe that creates an excessive amount of paranoia. But anyway, I'm looking at this email I got from him on the 22nd of July, and it says, you know, he feels that he said the first thing he says is, this is all getting a bit too curious for me. So,
well, one name that doesn't surface here that comes to my mind is Sherman Skolnick and Wanta. Now, isn't there a connection between Skolnick?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, if you do a Google search on Skolnick and Wanta, you'll see that there is a clearly documented, or at least in Skolnick's work, there's a documented link between Wanta, Mark Rich, and international finance matters that I haven't really gone into.
Now, one would think Skolnick's on top of a lot of these things. He's a lot of his material was played on CKLN many years ago. He's also regularly on Toronto radio now on a commercial radio station every Sunday.
Right.
I respect him, and he
respects me, I believe. We have a kind of a loose familiarity with each other.
Have you ever thought of discussing the Vreeland situation with Skolnick?
No, we haven't really been in touch about this too much. I think I've emailed him a couple of times about Wanta and wanting more information, seeing what he had. I was actually more in fact, the last email that went out to him was on the 12th of August. I emailed him, said, still working hard on Vreeland and Leo Wanta for Guerrilla News. I asked him point blank, what evidence do you have that Children's Defense Fund was a CIA front? And I didn't get a response to that. So, he's accused this very, very mainstream, very well-known charity, Children's Defense Fund, of being a CIA front. So that's, you know, that's something that I was like, you know, where's the substantiation, Mr. Skolnick? And did not get a response.
Okay.
You place a certain amount of significance on the pens that he used to write the for better or worse has been described as a warning note by Mike Rupert and others.
Yeah.
Could you explain the significance of the pens?
Sure. Well, as we know, Vreeland's the most well-known thing that Vreeland is notorious for is writing a note, allegedly, this time last year or so, not this time last year, but August 11th and 12th of last year, 2001, he was in jail, and he allegedly wrote what he describes as a memo, of what he describes as loose notes having to do with information that he claims that he got in Moscow or viewed in Moscow from documents that he was currying or messengering for the Office of Naval Intelligence. And these notes that he wrote were kind of a rough draft of a memo that he wanted to get to the Director of Naval Intelligence, Vern Clark. Since you talked about what this note is, let me just mention real quickly. What Vreeland says is that this was never meant to be a warning letter, but more like he did want to warn certain people in the government, but it wasn't exactly a letter to the world because, again, if you look at the letter, it's not exactly clear what some of the references are to. So,
but to be fair, it's been described by people who have looked into this story, perhaps not as extensively as us
mm-hmm.
and yourself,
mm-hmm.
but it's been described to some people as a detailed warning of what was to happen on September 11th.
Well, and it's also been described by people like David Corn as vague and undetailed. And I would actually argue that it is relatively detailed. And that it is uncanny that if he did in fact write it on August 11th, it's uncanny that a note that says Bin Laden, World Trade Center, White House, among other details, it does seem to predict 9/11. It does seem to be prescient about it. And I feel that if Vreeland did write this on August 11th and 12th, then that does in fact prove that he and other people in U.S. intelligence had a lot of forewarning about 9/11, which puts the spotlight on the Bush White House and then asks, why did they not stop the carnage, the disaster?
You believe that there is something in that note that is actionable from an intelligence standpoint?
Yeah.
Could you be specific about that?
Yeah. I think there's something in my story that's actionable in general, that if the case can be made that Vreeland has these connections and Vreeland was in fact ONI, if that case can be made, if that argument can be made, and if it can be, I guess I think I'm just trying to like argue as if we're in a court of law, we're in a court of public opinion as independent media people. And I think what I'm trying to do is just make a case for reasonable doubt that Vreeland is just a simple con man. And I think I've made a pretty good case. I'm not trying to say that I know conclusively who he is or who he was working for or where he's getting money now, but I do think I make a strong case that a jury could not, or the jury of us, the public, the international public, we as concerned citizens of Earth can't say, oh, this guy's just a two-bit con man, because the story is just inconsistent. There's just too many people that are high up, former ONI, former CIA, former Hungarian arms dealers, or current Hungarian arms dealers, former U.S. Treasury operatives for the Reagan White House. Too many people are saying, yes, this guy, it was actually former ONI. And therefore, since we're talking now about the main crux of this subject, his note, I would say that, yes, there is something actionable about the data in his note. There's something that at least demands a fair inquiry. It demands that the man be allowed to remain in Canada, you know, for a while longer, because I feel that he's in danger if he's extradited back to this country.
If you saw the note before September 11th, which nobody did, with the exception of Vreeland and possibly the people who sealed it for him.
Okay. Well,
what would it have told you about what was going to happen?
What Vreeland has told me, first of all, Ron, is that the note is not, the note does not exist exclusively or independently. It was never meant to. That the note was actually just the first page. At one point, actually, I'll tell you this. Vreeland told me that the note that's on the internet is actually, two half pages of, other parts of a 37-page memo that he was trying to write to Vern Clark.
We've been told that about the two halves of paper as well.
Okay, good. Then you know that. I mean, for what it's worth, I mean, if you're trying to ask me what is this note supposed to do, well, obviously it can't do much on its own, but it is theoretically a part of a larger document.
Okay, now you're saying that in your article, at least the version I have, I quote your article, dissecting the note. Vreeland's notes were part of his planned 37-page memo to Admiral Vern Clark. First interview that I did with Vreeland, he mentioned this long tome that he either suggests that he did write or that he did send or that he does have. Now, if for the first time in your article, it says planned. Now, what you're saying is that in your meeting with Vreeland, he's saying he cannot show the full document. So the full document has been written. Is that clear?
Well,
according to Vreeland.
I mean, maybe what I'm trying to do is just back away from alleging that it does exist, but he says it exists. And maybe the word planned is vague at that point. Maybe it needs to be reexamined in the final draft.
All right. But basically, according to... and you've met Vreeland face-to-face.
Correct.
And discussed this with him.
Correct.
Is it your opinion that Vreeland says that this 37-page memo exists, that it exists in his... It is his property now. It wasn't sealed in any court document or... I mean, he's saying, I guess it was done in jail, is he?
I think he is, yeah. And it's a good question, and I wish that... one thing that I have not done for this story is actually gotten in touch with Paul Slansky, attorney in Canada.
Good luck.
Yeah, right. I've voicemailed him numerous times and talked to people in his office numerous times. But that's one of my main questions for Slansky, is because there was allegations, or Vreeland said at one point that they were going to release the 37-page memo as part of the extradition hearing. But now Vreeland is saying that he actually is angry and frustrated at the experience and that he doesn't care about the world anymore and that the world can go to hell in a handbasket, which actually kind of scares me a little bit. But then again, Vreeland's lied to me, so I'm not exactly sure what to believe directly from Vreeland's mouth. And, you know, you always have to, like, check something with a couple other people who are credible whenever Vreeland says something to you. Anyway, so my answer to you is, do I know for certain this 37-page memo exists? No, I don't. But I think Paul Slansky might know, because at one point he may or may not have been considering entering it as evidence into the extradition hearing.
Now, Sander, when you met with Vreeland,
yeah,
and you'd start talking about something like the 37-page note. Now, it seems to me, I'm pretty curious. I'm sure you're pretty curious. At any time, did you start probing a little bit?
Oh, yeah. I probed him on this numerous times. There's a lot of documents that people want that Vreeland will always respond immediately with a no. There's a lot of documents that he alleges that he has that he came back from Moscow with.
Yes.
At one point in our first interview back in April on the phone, I asked him about that kind of thing. And
what possible reason could he have for not releasing those documents under the current circumstances? I mean, he's basically, when he's in jail, he's, my view of it, he's saying that the, why aren't the authorities saving me? You know, they've dropped the ball on me. They've left me out to hang out to dry, right? And then, so he goes through that whole epiphany, comes out of it, and he's saying, oh, they're going to come and kill me. They want me back in the United States, and they're going to kill me. And he supposedly has all of these documents, and you're saying that he seems to think he has nothing left to live for. Why wouldn't he take the ultimate revenge and just bring forth all of these documents to prove that that the system is so corrupt? I mean, has he got to lose?
Which, incidentally, is exactly what he said publicly in the interview that he did with Greg that he was going to do.
Yeah, I can't speak for him. Yeah. I don't know his motives. I do know this. I do know that he doesn't want to. Hurt people. He also
You mean jeopardize the other couriers?
Certainly that. But I also, he doesn't want to help start a war. I mean, then that, of course, I'm flattering him with that comment because that assumes that he has, you know, some hot information. Because the other side of the coin that I want to present is that, let's think of him again as, you know, who is he psychologically? I mean, this is a guy in trouble. This is a guy with not a lot of friends. I think there's got to be a level of ego and a level of protectiveness about, and a very specialization, a kind of mental specialization of his information. You know, so even if it turns out the documents that he has or the 37-page memo is not actually as hot as the rest of, it's not as hot as what has actually been released as the note, you know, it might be really important to him, and maybe that's why he's privileging that information in his own mind. But at this point, this is me conjecturing about, trying to understand Vreeland.
But Sander, don't you think that you said he doesn't want to start a war? But don't you think that releasing information about Saddam Hussein was conspiring to do the 9/11 attack and funneling information through Vladimir Putin and so on, implicating Russia and Iraq, two known, one a former enemy, I suppose, of the United States, one a current enemy of the United States over the past decade. Don't you think that this is information that would prompt people to create war, to have the justification for war?
Yeah, actually, I think you're right, and especially as the U.S. Tests the waters currently, and is trying to think about how can we justify internationally attacking Iraq, and
How does that jibe with you saying that he doesn't want to start a war?
Well, let's actually back away from what trying to understand Vreeland, his personality, and think about this as Vreeland's in control.
So he didn't say that he didn't want to start a war.
Yeah, he did.
He did?
Yeah.
But the thing is,
in April, he said, "I don't want to start World War III."
Right, but in many ways, he is doing that.
Yeah, it's true. It's true, and that makes me think that I wonder sometimes. Again, this is speculation, but I wonder sometimes who he's working for, really. And there's been speculation from different sources about maybe Vreeland is still ONI. Not only was he ONI, but he might be still ONI. And you have to wonder, is the whole Saddam Hussein connection possibly part of a Bush White House public opinion making mechanism to try to turn the population in favor of attacking Iraq?
Well, I guess I'll believe that more if, when the hearing starts happening next week, that the Vreeland story really does go worldwide on the major networks, and the Iraq situation is front and center with that. I guess I'll believe that then.
Look at the timing. It could actually happen, couldn't it?
I have no problem believing the government would spread disinformation in order to gain support for a military action against Iraq. What I do have problems with is that they would pick somebody whose credibility is so easy to challenge.
In my experience, that's not actually all that unusual. Sometimes you need somebody you can burn real fast if you had to.
My understanding of what's going to happen next week is that it's basically a slam dunk for the prosecution.
I think Vreeland is, like I said before, has acceded to that.
Right.
What's the word I'm looking for? He's
resigned.
What?
Resigned.
Resigned himself to that, right.
Yeah.
Which actually maybe means that you won't see any. Maybe he thinks it's kind of like the Lewanta railroading, that it doesn't really even matter what level of documents he shows anymore. That
I don't think he has the opportunity to present any more documents. My understanding is that time has come and gone. However, as you know, I'm not a lawyer.
Right. But have you seen a copy of his habeas corpus application? That's really worth checking out. I mean, that's a level of paper documentation that is pretty easily accessible from the courts.
Oh, yes.
Well, maybe my piece is sort of a best of the habeas corpus application, because the stuff that I really found what raised red flags is in that document.
Well, isn't it that there were mistakes made in terms of his incarceration?
Oh, sure. There's inconsistencies everywhere.
No, but I'm saying the way that the authorities in Canada
Well, sure. Yeah, there you go.
Incarcerated him.
not the way that authorities in Canada, but his official arrest records show that he was ripping off the Scotch Fruptine furniture store the same day that he was being either arraigned or arrested in New York.
According to Vreeland.
Vreeland.
According
right.
to Vreeland. I mean, have you ever found any documents that he was being arraigned or any documentation at all from those jurisdictions?
No. The New York, there are no more New York court records about Vreeland. I did a thorough search. In fact, what is posted on Guerrilla News Network is part of the evidence supporting documents is I provided the report I got. I did like a search on five of his aliases in New York, and they had no records of that arrest.
And if one were to be cynical, they might suggest that those arrest records never existed in the first place.
Or they've been scrubbed. I don't know. Yeah, either way. But now wait a minute. If they never existed in the first place, why then? Then that means you, Greg, then can have provided an argument that shows that there's some sort of falsification in Vreeland's arrest records, the records that were provided at the time of his arrest in Canada.
The records that I've seen were incomplete, and as much as said on them that there may be inconsistencies.
Yes, but
I believe that a more thorough and accurate arrest record is going, or record of offenses is going to be presented in court. That's my understanding.
But hold on a second. I don't know if I've made my point because yes, it does say that New York is going to provide more information. That's what it says about his arrests. But it also says that he was arrested and arraigned for drunk driving and grand larceny of an auto. In New York around the same time that he originally said he was. But then you do a search in New York for those court records, and they're gone. They're scrubbed. And what's interesting is that, and this is the main point that I make in my article, is that there's obviously either an error or perhaps a falsification in his arrest records, because the same day that he was accused of credit card fraud at this furniture store in Michigan, he was allegedly also in New York being arrested or arraigned for the grand larceny of an auto charge.
We've talked to witnesses from the furniture store.
Judy Horgan.
We've talked to the police officer who led the investigation. We know that Judy Horgan dealt with Delmart Vreeland before. He was somebody who was known to her at the time this fraud in, I guess it was, December 1999, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say what I said in my article. Judy Horgan seems fishy to me. I don't know why, but I mean, I say it in the article. I called her up. There's something kind of off about her.
She's outraged at the suggestion that anyone believes what the guy says.
There's something about what she said to me, though, that seemed to. Again, this is conjecture. This is not.
She said things to us like, oh, you can't believe him.
She's also in awe of Delmart Vreeland.
Right, yeah, that's true. She said that he's... I've listened to your interview with her. That raised questions for me, too. To say this, when I talked to Judy Horgan, she seemed to be overly eager to discredit Vreeland. It just seemed to me that maybe she was put up to it by somebody else. Well, and there's clearly documented inconsistencies in Vreeland's arrest record. He can't possibly have been in New York and Michigan on the same day being prosecuted and arrested and arraigned for two crimes at once. You know, maybe it's an error.
Judy Horgan, basically, she felt violated. She felt that her job was put on the line there, and luckily she still has her job there. And that, I mean, obviously, people who are the victims of crimes often get deeply involved in the people who committed this violation against them.
I would just say that, like, you got to remember, you don't know for certain. I don't know for certain, and you don't know for certain either. I mean, it's like, you know, it's good to, like, feel Judy Horgan's humanity and her feel for her as a victim, but we don't know who everyone is. We don't know who everyone's working for, and keep that in mind. I think we highly honed level of analysis on this story. I don't know if Judy Horgan really hurt Vreeland in the big picture, because I don't know if anybody really cares in the big picture.
And she was a little reluctant even to talk to us.
Who is?
Judy.
Judy Horgan was a bit reluctant. I want to ask a question about Captains Burroughs and Stewart, Master Chief Blanks, and Captain Coster.
Sure. It's something I have not yet followed up on yet, Greg, but I plan on it.
That was our question.
And, yeah, it's actually, I flagged it for my editor. I was like, thank God, finally something verifiable. But, yeah, let's keep that for, like, the second interview.
I think one of the bombshells that you dropped in your article is that Gulati's no longer on the case. So what's the deal? Why is he no longer working for Vreeland?
You know, I can't get him to comment on it. All I have been told at the office is that Slansky is on the case. I know that the habeas corpus application was submitted with both of their names on the front cover. I know that Gulati has been harassed. Both Slansky and Gulati have been harassed. Dead cats have showed up on their porches, and they've had the windows of their cars smashed and burglaries that may or may not have something to do with this. It seems to me that there's been a level of harassment, and perhaps Gulati is responding to that. I can't answer for Gulati because he will not comment publicly about whether or not he, in fact, went back on his comment or his word about abandoning a client. But what I do know is that Gulati is no longer on the case.
We missed the pens, so let's go back and talk briefly about that.
When Vreeland allegedly wrote his note on August 11th and 12th of 2001, he claims in his habeas corpus application that he used a blue ballpoint pen, I believe it was, the kind of which was not official prison issue. The pens were later confiscated, and people said, where'd you get these pens? And he said, oh, my lawyers gave them to me. And they said, well, that's a violation of prison protocol. And he was like, oh, I didn't know. So suffice to say, the pens were removed. And part of his argument is that if you do some sort of test on the actual ink of the original note, it will show that they were written with a pen, the kind of pen that was confiscated from him shortly after August 12th. That's the argument made there. And I think it's actually a very interesting argument.
But doesn't that argument...
if it's true, then that will actually show the date of the note being written. Now, see, this is the thing. There's been a lot of loose talk in internet journalism covering this story, different people that are pro-Vreeland saying, oh, well, the note has never been the timing of the note has never been disputed, or that the prosecution doesn't question that the note was submitted or given or put into Vreeland's personal belongings around August 12th in prison. But that's actually not true. The prosecution does question officially whether or not the note was written prior to August 12th or after September 11th. But it's kind of funny the way that I learned this, because I was in contact with an assistant DA in Prosecutor Kevin Wilson's office. Her name is Dorette Huggins, and I asked her if that was in fact true, that no one questions that when the note was written, the timing of the note. And she had first said, yes, that's correct, no one questions it, and then like put the phone down, talked to some people, and then came back and said, oh, I'm sorry, wait a minute. Our official statement now is that we think that the note was actually written after September 11th. So I don't know if that's significant to anybody else besides me, but it's pretty significant to me that the prosecution didn't even have their story straight.
One of the names on the warning note is a guy named Chalva Chigrinsky, who is, we seem to all concur on this point, he's a Russian businessman.
That's correct. He is a Russian businessman.
He is involved in the oil business.
That's correct.
With a company as the I think he's the chairman of the board, if I'm not mistaken, of a company that is listed on the London Stock Exchange, Sibir Energy by name.
Right.
You mention in the article that he has dual citizenship in Russia and Israel.
Right, right. Yeah, you're probably going to point out that it was something that I mentioned and don't really follow up on.
Well, I just wondered what you're suggesting there. I mean, or what that suggests to you.
Sure. It's one of the few things that I was able to dig up that's new and possibly a piece of the puzzle on Chava. Chigrinsky, I think it's how you pronounce it. Vreeland's very good at pronouncing it. Chigrinsky. Anyway. So it's kind of like... It's something, you know, I don't think this is going to be like the last thing I write about Vreeland. I think this piece is probably going to be the start of, you know, maybe a little book or a series of articles. So it's, you know, I tried to dig up what I could about different characters in the story and try to find what was newsworthy.
So in short, you think it may have some relevance to something in the future, possibly?
Well, let's go back for a second. The answer is yes. At the time, understand that I was and have been deeply immersed in information about what Leo Wanta was doing as an international financier, especially around 1993. There's this thing called UN Contract 4, which was, I think, I don't know where the plan is now, but I believe it was aborted. It was a $5 trillion program that different international capitalists were putting together for humanitarian causes. $5 or $10 billion of the program was going to split between the State of Israel and the PLO, $5 billion each, just to lay down their arms and almost like, you know, a big fat cat payoff for peace. Now, a reporter could allege that perhaps one of the reasons that Leo Wanta, you know, went down and was taken out in 93 was because perhaps certain other international financiers were not in favor of peace and felt that, you know, maybe, you know, we'll never have peace in the Middle East until, you know, the Palestinians are completely eliminated or vice versa. The Israelis are completely wiped off the face of the map. You know, I'm not alleging anybody in particular here, but, you know, it could have been that somebody was politically disinclined to let UN Contract 4 come to fruition. And I'm not, you know, so anyway, that's that. So when I saw the dual citizenship for Chalba, I kind of was like, that's interesting.
I also wanted to ask you about what for me is the least convincing part of anything that Vreeland has claimed thus far, possibly. But it involves Mark Bastion, the Canadian diplomat. He's said publicly in several interviews, including the one he did with Greg, including the 35 questions and answers that appeared on the From the Wilderness website.
Right. Those pithy answers that are so characteristic of Vreeland.
Well,
anyway, go ahead.
I would suggest that there's a reason that those answers were so short.
Yes, we know.
Yeah.
That,
did I tell you about that?
Yeah, you did. Perhaps he was coached a little bit by Papa Rupert.
Could be.
Which I don't think is a complete crime, but anyway, go ahead.
No, but I mean, you know, it's something that I think is better left for. I mean, if you're trying to be an objective journalist looking into something, I might suggest that telling somebody what's going to serve him better is. At least highly irregular.
Right. But then again, you don't have complete proof that he did that.
Oh yeah, I do. Did I not send you the note?
No, you sent me the notes, right? But are you sure that was Rupert's handwriting? That
he's admitted it.
The way
he I questioned him on it, and he did admit that he wrote it. Mark Bastion dies December 12th, 2000, shortly after Vreeland's arrested.
Right.
The in interviews, Mr. Vreeland has told us that he and other people, that he did not make that allegation until August 8th, 2001, that Mr. Bastion was murdered. The autopsy, the coroner's report, was delivered to the Bastion family on December 19th, 2000.
When do we know that Vreeland found out about it? My best answer about this is, I'm sorry, I don't have the full history of Bastion down. What I do know is that I've got a paragraph about it in the current draft of the story. And when I showed the entire story to Kathleen Harris from the Ottawa Sun, who's a professional reporter, despite what, you know, we might think about the Ottawa, or what you guys might think about the Ottawa Sun, a mainstream professional reporter from an established newspaper agreed with me that there was something to the Vreeland story that, as slightly psychologically damaged as he is, that there was nuggets of truth throughout his story. And the nuggets of truth, that's exactly what she said. So And she's the one that really is the expert on Bastion. And
but the thing is, it just seems like less than clairvoyant to come out with that statement all that time after it had been, you know, after the coroner's report had been delivered to at least some members of the public.
Well, not Vreeland when he's in jail. I mean, you guys ever been in jail? You don't get everything you want. You don't get all the information you want about stuff. So, what I do know about Vreeland and Bastien is that when Vreeland said that natural causes was most likely not the cause of death, some sort of reevaluation was done of the Bastien death, they did find things that they hadn't discovered before. And that's what gives Kathleen Harris cause to say that there are nuggets of truth in Rin's testimony about Bastien.
I also wanted to talk, or at least touch briefly on the Deers records, because that's...
Sure, that's, I think it's significant. You and email correspondence, you've suggested that I find out how hard it is to modify a Deers record. I think it's a good point. I do plan on doing that.
Well, I mean, part of there's a clue to that, a very good clue in Vreeland's own affidavit in one of the exhibits.
Yeah,
I don't
believe that it's easy to modify these Deers records. We're talking about official military records, and to sum up and let the listeners know what we're talking about.
Right.
The Deers stands for Defense Enrollment Eligibility Reporting Service. It's a military record that talks about your basic data of your eligibility, you as a military person, who you are, what your blood type is, et cetera, when you enlisted and when you left the military. And part of Freeland's own habeas corpus application is a transcript of him calling up naval records in Norfolk, Virginia, and talking to Petty Officer Guilford, Terry Guilford. And Guilford said, "This is fishy. You're a fishy guy. I don't know why Vreeland was in jail at the time, by the way. And Guilford said, "This is fishy. I don't know why it says that you were only in for 5 months, but it also says that you attained the rank of lieutenant." So that was that. And like you say, Vreeland said, "Well, that exit date is wrong, and somebody needs to change that exit date because it's wrong."
Actually, I believe he asked Guilford what he would do to make the records more believable in so many words. And Guilford responds that he would change the date
Right. Maybe you're inferring something.
Well,
I don't infer, but I understand your point. I understand your point. But so the listeners understand what we're talking about, the way I see it, the way the transcript goes, as far as I'm concerned, is that Vreeland's main point in submitting this with his habeas corpus application is to say that you can't join the Navy and get kicked out of it for 5 months and then have the rank of lieutenant. So obviously, when the Navy submits records to Canadian court saying, "Oh, this guy is full of crap. He was only with the Navy for 5 months." Vreeland's response to that is, "Then why do my Deers records show the rank of lieutenant?" And you're saying it's easy to modify Deers records. I don't think that's true, and I certainly don't think it's easy to call up somebody on the phone and say, "Please add the rank of lieutenant to my Deers records."
But you can enter the Deers site on the internet. It has a clear warning there saying that if you alter things and they're not true, or if you enter it illegally, if you aren't meant to be in there, you can be prosecuted to the full extent of the law.
I did contact somebody who was in ONI and continues to serve in the U.S. military.
Oh, good. What did he say?
He told me that that's obviously exactly what Vreeland did.
Hmm.
But he didn't want to discuss it publicly, but he did suggest and be used as a source because he's still in the military.
Uh-huh.
But what he did say was that virtually anyone in the military would be able to tell you that. Would be able to tell you that you can go in and alter the records and that's what the system is designed for.
Mm-hmm.
It's designed so that you can change information in the Deer system.
Okay, point taken. But let's go back before the records were modified. And then Vreeland was in the military, and according to the official records, for 5 months, the rank of lieutenant, and at the time, that the conversation was going on between Petty Officer Guilford and Vreeland. Vreeland said, "What do you see there?" And Guilford said, "This is really weird. You know, you joined the military in 85, and still your blood type is blank. You know, people that just joined up, you know, sometimes the blood type will be, you know, not known. But for it to be blank for so long, that's really, really fishy. So what does he say? Like, kind of a deep cover field, or you're kind of a low key guy.
That's
you're
right.
Like, you know, Guilford's like, I've talked to Guilford myself, and he's a, you know, pretty friendly, gung-ho kind of low-level seaman, and he says, you know, he says to Vreeland, "Oh, well, you're just kind of a low-key type guy." He knew exactly who Vreeland was. He effectively said, you know, this is, you know, he said, "Be careful." He said, you know, "Take care of yourself." When they were getting off the phone, there was a kind of a camaraderie. There seemed to be an understanding between the two that Petty Officer Guilford knew exactly who Vreeland was. Because Guilford knew his shit. If his life is naval records, and what comes up when Vreeland calls him up is this fishy record, he'll say, "Oh, this is fishy. There's something not right about this. And you know, take care of yourself. Whatever you're in the middle of, because you know you need to watch your back."
Why does Jeffrey Sands feature in your interview with or your article about Vreeland?
Vreeland mentioned him. I asked about his directive at ONI. I said, "What was your main mission?" And Vreeland talked about Sands.
And why? Why do you think he brought him up in particular? Who is he? I have no idea of who this person is.
Oh, Vreeland said he was a drug dealer.
Where?
I don't know.
Sander, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This has been really professional and cordial, and I appreciate you guys taking the time.